Hello, everybody out there. This is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David. One of these interview broadcasts comes to you generally 3 days a week on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. You can see it on my various platforms on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, VK, Twitch, and LinkedIn, as well as on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and the Facebook page of KABU Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon. And speaking of here in Portland, Oregon, there will be a protest at Revolution Hall at 3 p.m. this afternoon and a march to the waterfront. And I'll be singing at Revolution Hall. And today I have the great pleasure of introducing to you, some of you, or many of you already know who you're about to be hearing talk and discuss things with me because, well, for one thing, he was just interviewed just the other day on KABU. Joshua Tucker, fantastic photographer, but mainly known more as a filmmaker, award-winning filmmaker, in fact, in his new documentary about various resistance movements, intersecting resistance movements, uprisings in Chile called Veins of Resistance is out and about, and the website is veinsofresistance.net, and it's fantastic. And with no further ado, let me just bring onto the screen Joshua Tucker. Great to have you here on the other side of the world.
I haven't seen you in a long time. It's so great to see you again.
Absolutely. And the last time I saw you was, in fact, in Alaska, where you're from. Is that right?
Yeah.
And that's one thing. I mean, when I went to the first time and the second time, it was the only two times I've been to Alaska. I was just, for one thing, struck by the natural beauty of the place. I mean, it's just impossible to describe if you really haven't been there. And also in the Arctic generally, and the lighting. And I just wonder, first of all, do you think you got into filmmaking and photography largely because you grew up in Alaska and just looking around, you're like, oh my God, I have to be able to try to capture this, or is that just coincidental?
Well, it's a good question. There's a lot of things going on there. I would say, yeah, in some ways I did get into filmmaking because of living in Alaska. Although it's a little bit more of a story than that. So I actually grew up in Oregon and my family moved to Alaska in 2005. So in 2005, I was going to the University of Texas, and later in 2005, I had a really kind of definitive radicalizing experience for me where I joined the Common Ground Collective in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And so we were staying at the home of Malik Rahim and providing direct relief to people in Louisiana facing this horrible crisis of the hurricane and the government neglect and the racist vigilante groups, and it all sort of compounded. And so it wasn't until after that, you know, when I was 20, that I got to Alaska. And so my family, as I was in New Orleans, they're like, hey, we're moving to Alaska. You should come visit. And I said, well, you know, things are pretty busy in New Orleans right now, but I'll get up there eventually. And I did. And ended up finishing school. My bachelor's in journalism. I'm an independent journalist. And I made my first feature film, which was called We Can't Eat Gold. And so here's where, get to your question, Alaska really did shape, you know, my relationship with the camera. Because
your first full length documentary was about Alaska, right? The Pebble Mine, yeah.
Right, exactly. And you've written some great songs about that and followed that too. You know, for folks who don't know, it's the would be the largest open pit mine in North America, potentially in the world, among the headwaters of the world's most productive salmon spawning streams, right? And so these are in Bristol Bay, Alaska. Where over 50% of wild-caught salmon in Alaska comes from. And wild-caught salmon actually represents over 50% of the salmon that's sold in the United States. So that means that 25% of all the salmon, wild salmon that we eat in the United States comes from this one place. And they want to put a giant open pit mine there. And so the film, We Can't Eat Gold, which is online for free at wecanteatgold.net, you know, we profiled Yupik elders and youth. indigenous elders and youth, and they explained how they've passed this struggle to protect their land from generation to generation. There's been, you know, at least 17 years of indigenous resistance to this proposed project, and they've been able to hold it off so far. So it's been quite a struggle. And that's how I really got into film, was saying, okay, how can we bridge this gap where you know, my mom is a cultural anthropologist, and she actually participated in an EPA report on the proposed mine that was definitive in the process, where she's talking with elders and trying to transmit that traditional ecological knowledge. And so that for me with the camera is my central question, right? Like, so how can we take these seemingly disparate worlds and connect them with a camera? And connect, you know, that traditional ecological knowledge, that indigenous wisdom that's so needed in you know, this world today that is, you know, rapidly losing species diversity and clean air and air in general.
Joshua, just something you said in passing on your way to Alaska when you mentioned joining the Common Ground Collective and going to New Orleans in 2005. One of the things you mentioned were gangs of racist vigilantes, and I'm just can you just expand on that a little bit? I know we're not going
sure.
in. My interviews are very orderly, but just because I mean, this is you know, I knew the cops were gangs of racist vigilantes in New Orleans and committed a lot of horrible atrocities during that time against all kinds of people there. But talk about these are, you're not the cops. You're not talking about the cops. You're not talking about Blackwater. You're talking about like more privately organized gangs of racist vigilantes.
Yeah. Well, you know. So the work of A.C. Thompson, award-winning journalist A.C. Thompson, on this matter is definitive. You know, A.C. Thompson has since gone on to have multiple, you know, feature-length frontline documentaries about his work investigating hate groups. One of them filmed by one of my heroes, Rick Rowley, of Big Noise Films. But, you know, back in 2005, A.C. Thompson was still on the case, just, you know, with a slightly less expensive camera. We were in the Algiers Point neighborhood on the west bank of the Mississippi River. And so near the terminal for the Algiers ferry, for example, was a house where a group of people who had decided to ride out the storm and decided not to evacuate were staying. And they would post signs, "You loot, we shoot," and they would ride around in pickup trucks with guns. And Thompson was able to link them to several killings in our neighborhood. And so this is a house that was like six blocks from where we were living. And people were living in fear because there were these vehicles full of, and you know, one of the things that I remember about New Orleans was that it wasn't the first time that I saw a dead body, but it was the first time I saw one left in the street and just covered with a piece of metal and just left there for days and days. And so they're
after being shot or after being
with a bullet hole in the chest. It was a African American male. So there were people getting shot around there, and A.C. Thompson, and then the film, which I've started this. If folks are into radical documentary, I've started this channel on this new sort of radical YouTube called Colectiva, where I'm putting up all these films. And so one of the films up there actually films and interviews some of the guys in this house by an amazing Danish filmmaker named Rasmus Holm, who was another big inspiration for me to get into film. And it's his film, Welcome to New Orleans, which is really a very good look at specifically the birth of Common Ground and the context of organized racism that we were facing. And, you know, so people were at Common Ground, people were sitting on the porch with access to self-defense stuff. Guns in self-defense of the situation there. And I mean, if you look at Scott Crowe's got writing on that, a lot of people do.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, one of those many things that have happened just in the past 20 years, just in the, you know, my adult life, you know, in the latter half of my adult life, that these are things that so many of us are aware of. But and when you hear the mass media talking about the situation in the United States today, they often like to say this is unprecedented, and this is and certainly there's a lot of things happening that are unprecedented, but actually. Armed gangs of racist vigilantes and armed self-defense from armed gangs of racist vigilantes is nothing new in this country, including in very recent history.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just in terms of, when I was looking around at your amazing work, I mean, this film is incredible and you've done so much. I love your photography. And one of the things I came across as just, you know, sleuthing around on the internet was one of the crowdfunders you did for this film, which was not successful at all. And I just, and I just think that's, you know, we've all done, I mean, I don't know about everybody else out there, but I think many people watching this, if you've attempted to do a crowdfunder, it probably was like that one and it didn't really go anywhere. And I've done lots of crowdfunders that didn't go anywhere. And a couple that actually did, that where I actually was able to fund a project as much as I wanted to fund it. Right. But most of the time they don't go very well. And I, you know, having just been reading this book, I did mention to you in a message of the death of the artist. I just wonder about the process.
Yeah, I mean,
you ended up over the course of 4 years working with a whole bunch of other people, putting out this incredible documentary, which is, I think, a really important document of what's been going on in Chile for the past few years, in the world, which is, you know, I've been experiencing so many uprisings. And I want to talk more about the film, but about the process of making it and how you managed to actually put it out. It took years of and apparently unsuccessful efforts at fundraising. And how can you just talk about the process for all those people out there who are struggling to produce content in this modern era of everything being free online?
Well, thanks. That's a really important question. And I think, you know, especially with the indie media roots we share, having been involved in this kind of thing for a while, I think it is really important to share with people that, that yes, it is hard, but yes, it is possible, which is basically the story of this, right? So I'd have to add it up. I think I've raised close to $10,000 on Indiegogo over the course of my many attempts.
And typically documentaries cost in the tens of thousands, right? To put out a documentary, that's normal to have a budget in the tens of thousands, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if I was, you know, if this was funded by, the Ford Foundation or the Knight Foundation or something like that, they would fund a project like Veins of Resistance. They would see an overall budget for a project of Veins of Resistance, you know, in the $200,000 or $300,000 range minimum. And then maybe the Ford Foundation can provide as much as $100,000 to $150,000. So you're looking at matching funds and getting it together from all different sides. And so my question is, okay, like, but that, how do I get from where I am to where I can do this, in a way that it'll have a fair chance to reach, an audience, right? And so it's pretty difficult, so film is kind of like yacht racing or something like that, where it's like this really expensive pastime, mostly carried out by rich people. But there is this potential for film to be this world bridger, right, that connects these disparate realities and helps us see the struggles of other movements and learn from them and be inspired for them. So even though the broad success in the industry does cost a lot of money, my motives aren't financial, right? My motives are journalistic and artistic, and so I just do what I can, right? Like, recently the cops smashed my camera and so I didn't have money to get anything better. And this, they don't even make this camera anymore because it's so old. But what I was able to do was buy another used version of the same camera. so that I can shop parts between the two and just keep the same camera that I filmed Veins of Resistance on working, right? So you end up making decisions like that. It is possible, right? What happens is they say, oh, your film may take anywhere from 3 to 10 years, depending on whether you can pay people to work with you, because there's like, you know, at minimum 20 different jobs, or whether, yeah, God forbid, you have to go get a master's to learn how to do one of those jobs to finish the film, right? Which is what I'm considering now, is doing an online editing master's, because there's a lot more to learn about that. But the good news is that it is possible. And I want to thank the people who funded me. I mean, you know, you may see a Indiegogo for $1,000 or $1,500 as not a success. To me, it's a tremendous success. To me, right, it's enabled me to do things like buy a projector, right? So I don't have to depend on the political sensibilities of other people deciding whether or not they want to screen a film that shows police violence. And I can say, let's just do it, right? I'm really grateful, and I've been able to you know, keep my dreams alive, and I think that's what we can all do together. I think that this idea that we would have commercial success, it shouldn't be abandoned. What I think about every day is keep my dreams alive and make dreams for other people and inspire other people, and that doesn't require us being like the industry.
I think it's really actually, I mean, when I saw that, you know, that crowdfunder where you raised $1,000, you know, I mean, of course, yeah, maybe there were multiple crowdfunders, of course, but when I came across that, I thought, look, this is actually something I think worth sharing with people, because we're talking about an award-winning filmmaker. And this is what happens when an award-winning filmmaker does a crowdfunding. It doesn't always, you hear about the success stories, and you don't hear about, and of course, you know, people are hearing about this film because it's done, right? And when it was in process, it's one of those things that's always in process, I guess. You know, when things are finished, you tend to hear about them more, right? I don't know.
Yeah, I think what I would say, what a big thing I learned about Indiegogo, since we're on the topic, is it is incredibly hard to get donations from people you don't know.
Yeah, it's all about networks, right? And then what if you're in Chile and most of your network are fellow protesters in Chile who make whatever
like they make. Our credit cards here don't even work on Indiegogo.
But, well, see, exactly. There we go.
Yeah, but yeah.
Where's
so
your network?
So as a word of advice for folks who do try crowdfunding, this is a format to get the people you already know and love to give you money.
Right.
This is not that people are going to come from the, you know, corners of the internet and discover you, unless you're paying for a lot of sponsored promotions, right, where you're reaching a broader audience than your own potentially.
That's why crowdfunding tends
a lot on that, right?
Yeah, it tends to work best for people who grew up with lots of friends who make a lot of money, according to the numbers.
Right, again, back to filmmaking is like yacht racing, right?
Yep, yacht racing, yeah.
But hey, like this is like, I see it as like the freaking Iditarod. Like, we're trying to get the vaccine through, we're trying to get the message through. You know, folks in Chile have figured out how to take down a racist constitution. Would you guys like to, let's get that message through the United States and everybody else where people need to reform their governing documents.
Yeah. Can we talk about that? I mean, this, what's been happening in Chile has just been amazing. And your documenting of it is amazing. And also the way you weave together these different movements, which are not necessarily immediately, sort of seen as related to each other, the student movement and the movement for having land for the Mapuche people not being constantly kicked off of their land. And it's just, I don't know where to start, but
there's a lot. I mean, we could start chronologically and then we wouldn't lose our place.
Chronologically. There's a really novel idea. Sure.
So chronologically, I think that a really important baseline to understanding what's going on in so-called Chile, right, is that, this conquistador arrived, Pedro de Valdivia, and
We're going way back. Okay.
Yeah, good. And he began this genocide against indigenous peoples in Chile, right? And the largest group language group. So it's like the Iroquois Confederation, where it's made up of various nations and similar languages, is the Mapuche peoples, right? And so within Mapuche, you have Huiche, Pehuenche, Tehuelche. There's a bunch of different dialects and language groups. So it represents a lot of people. The Mapuche have this sort of interesting situation, tragic and difficult situation, where they've never given up armed resistance, David, right? For over 500 years. Mm-hmm. So where a lot, even within Chile and in other places, a lot of indigenous groups either face complete or near complete genocide or come to some sort of agreement with the state, the Mapuche have this third road where they've continued armed resistance. We understand that relationship between the Spanish and the Catholic Church and the indigenous people underlies a lot of long-term issues in Chile. So for example, this conquistador, Pedro Valdivia, took a young Mapuche, a minor, under 18, as his slave, like his personal manservant. This guy's the young Mapuche boy was named Leftaro. And Leftaro later escaped. He then returned and killed Pedro de Valdivia, his enslaver. He beheaded him and was on the way to the capital of Chile that Pedro de Valdivia founded. He was only about 100 miles outside of town with a large force of Mapuches when he was finally stopped from taking over the whole country, right? And so that has been going back and forth, and armed resistance continues. When the Pope visited here, there were a couple helicopters that were burned. We have instances of 24 logging trucks burned at once, where these logging companies are logging lands that the Mapuche people claim to be theirs, that their land rights, their land claims have never been addressed. Their sovereignty has never been acknowledged. So then when we see these ongoing protests in Chile, we know that there's sort of that underlying it. Right. And I know that Idle No More in Canada and the resistance of the Unistoten and the rail blockades across Canada, that folks maybe in your neck of the woods are starting to see too, this sort of core nature of indigenous resistance is connecting to all the others and must be acknowledged in all the others. So that's what's been one of the roots here to this conflict.
And so much of the conflict in so many different contexts, whether you're talking about, I mean, because so much of your film is also about urban situations with housing and these things are all intimately related. Huh? I mean, people having access to the basic necessities of life, like housing, land, access to being able to grow food or eat food or just basics of education for all or education for only the privileged few. It's all questions of what's the commons and what is privately owned and something that for capitalists to profit off of while other people suffer, right? But these tactics of that are also so common and becoming more common of it seems of taking space and holding it and disputing the question of whose world is this, huh?
Right. No, thank you, David. Yeah, so Veins of Resistance focuses on three different kinds of occupations, right? So the first one is what we're starting to get to with the Mapuche is land occupations in indigenous territory, where indigenous communities move on to lands that timber companies and private entities think they have a title to, and they bring their livestock. And they build houses and they stay there. And, you know, many times the police branch of the Chilean military will bring in a raid and displace them pretty quick. A lot of people have died that way. But sometimes they're able to hold on. And so there are areas that the Chilean military calls La Zona Roja, right, the red zone, where these are very analogous to sovereign Zapatista territory in so-called Mexico, right? Where this is indigenous administered territory and the military is kept out by force. And so that's one of the kind of occupations. And you're right. This is all connected, right? So we think about the next kind of occupation in the film, urban land occupations, right? So facing this dispossession where these in many cases timber companies or mining companies, hydroelectric dams come in and drive indigenous people off their lands, and there's terrible poverty and hunger. And so what many of them do is go to the cities, and they say, I don't want to go to the city, you know, but it's a forced migration, especially during the Pinochet dictatorship when a lot of their land was appropriated all at once. And so when these displaced indigenous populations come to the city, a lot of them end up in these urban land occupations, which are like large tracts of waste industrial land, where they build communities, sometimes over 50,000 people. Some of these communities, Chile has some of the oldest, like La Victoria, that was founded by largely communists in the 1950s. You know, is still around, and now they have electricity and water, and they sort of regularize their building situation and stuff. But a lot of them aren't. A lot of them are you know, very modest, hand-built dwellings with scrap wood and no running water or electricity. And so the second type of occupation we follow in the film is these urban land occupations, where folks talk about how they were forced into this migration, how they're stuck in this situation where, you know, in addition to not having electricity or water provided, you know, they sometimes they have like a catchment system, a barrel off the roof and a hose and stuff like that. They don't have like a shower, for example, for, you know, and so, and they also don't have emergency services, right? So if there's a fire, which happens, or if there's a violent situation, there's very often no recourse for these communities. And so we follow in the St. Francis land occupation, a committee called the Hope Committee, which represents over 104 families for over 8 years that it took them to get to move into what is essentially like public housing, right? Because there was not enough public housing for them. So they had to wait for it to be built and chip in for it themselves and organize for it. You know, we're talking about a lot of folks who are daily workers who make money selling at the farmer's market or maybe collecting scrap metal. And so the idea that they would have to save hundreds and hundreds of dollars, you know, and they do it as a community. It's a real struggle. And I recently went back and screened Veins of Resistance with them in their new houses. And, you know, it's tragic. Some of them, members of the committee, died in the process, an 8-year process to get them homes. So it's been a really long odyssey for them. And then the third kind of occupation we study in the film are high school and university occupations, where the students take over their own educational institution, barricade the doors and windows, and live there for months at a time. And it might be a sort of comparable to what some people imagine as like a Occupy Wall Street protest camp, because these students are sleeping in the camp, they're cooking for each other, they're coordinating with other occupations, and it's a protest camp. So they're, you know, regularly painting banners, going out there and protesting. And so this is something that's been happening in Chile for a long time. You know, as we know, the CIA-backed coup in 73 brought Augusto Pinochet to power, a horrible dictator, killed and tortured, you know, well over 40,000 people, according to the tribunals and Amnesty International. And there's still a lot of impunity out there. And so even under this terrible repression in the last few years of the dictatorship, before they voted to end it in 1990, through a popular referendum, there were occupations, high school occupations, when you know, living under a dictatorship, when you could be shot for being out on the street, you still can sometimes. High school students were taking over their own high schools, barricading the doors and demanding free, quality education for everybody. And so that's only continued. So 2001 was a big year. 2006 was a big year. And that was called the March of the Penguins. It was when that movie came out, and the students marching in their school uniforms you know, people would joke that they look like penguins marching with the white and the black. And then, so 2011 was a big year. And then we get to the period where I was filming Veins of Resistance, 2015 to 2018. And 2015 and 16 were also really big years. And so
really
we get to a point in 2016 where there are 200 high schools being occupied by their own students, dozens and dozens of universities as well. We focus on the high school students, although there's some interviews with the university folks too. So 200 high schools occupied over the length of Chile, spread out over 2,000 kilometers, over 1,000 miles apart. So this isn't an isolated instance. It's a huge movement, right? And these students are not old enough to drive a car, but they can organize hundreds of thousands of people to go out to the street and are communicating with each other and making plans and forcing legislation and being broadly successful. And here is what I think the central learning in the film is one of them, and of these movements, and it's something I'd like to talk about with you, David, is what happens is these movements go from single issue movements looking for reform to mm-hmm. A broad movement that's for system change in general.
Yeah.
And does not see boundaries between different issues. But is one big all-encompassing movement, and that
do people refer to it as a name like the movement, like people used to say talk about the intersecting movements in the 60s here in the U.S. Sure. They used to use the term the movement, which kind of went out of fashion later. But is there a term like that kind of encompasses all the movements, or they were talking in the global justice movement?
But yeah, and I think that even beyond a specific name, because this is much more, obviously different people have different perspectives on this and different sort of levels of, you know, how far they've gone with it. But yeah, I think it's a really important discussion, to have about whether we're seeking incremental reforms and whether, you know, we can say, well, we want that money to go to education, not Social Security, or vice versa. Whether a movement can be divided like that or pitted against each other, or if it's a broader recognition that the whole neoliberal state is not serving the common interests of the people. And so to keep on with this chronological thing, that is a broad recognition that we saw on the part of the Chilean people in the referendum that happened a little over a week ago now.
Yeah, talk about that. How much of a big deal was this referendum, this constitutional change, this new constitution? It's massive.
Okay, so
and it was really brought about because of all these militant the militant social movement. It was, you'd say, the tactics of this movement that really directly brought about this massive change to the government's way of doing business.
I mean, sure.
Talk about
that. Well, I worry I'm just talking and talking, because if I tackle this, I'm going to talk for another 5 or 10 minutes too.
It's an important subject, I think. I mean, you know, I want to talk about we've been talking about your film, and that's also, you know, a big part of why I want to talk. But you're in Chile now, and this is an extremely important period of history in Chile right now. I also want to ask you some perspective on tactics and the situation here in the United States, because I think when you talk about the social movement and how you start out with one issue and then it expands, you can see that pattern very much happening with what is often, you know, the shorthand is Black Lives Matter, by which they don't necessarily mean the organization. They're talking about the movement, which is now something that has clearly very quickly turned into a vastly, you know, a bigger thing that encompasses all kinds of, essentially, without, you know, without using the term anti-capitalist explicitly, it is becoming what I would call what we might call an anti-capitalist movement. Guys, and when they're talking about how the average Black family cannot afford to live in a market rate 2-bedroom apartment in Portland, Oregon, just those kinds of statistics, it's like, okay, so housing is a racial justice issue, as well as a class issue and a question of capitalism. And, you know, I mean, the housing situation here is, as with many countries, it's completely out of control and controlled by venture capitalists.
I tried to pay rent in Portland. I can't do it anymore. I'm in Chile.
No, No, that's, I mean, most of the people I know in Portland have left the city, and I'm sure that's true of most of the people you knew that used to live in Portland. I mean, the city is completely unrecognizable. And I also incidentally lived in Boston, San Francisco, Seattle, and New York, all of which are completely unrecognizable yeah. from when I lived in them.
We tried to go to San Francisco recently. It's just like, so pricey. Everything's so pricey.
When I lived there, it was $300 a month for a room in a beautiful Victorian house. But that was in the early 90s.
And that's what I deal with in Chile. And so that I can handle, you know. But that's part of it, right? We were talking about the financing of these things. I make tremendous sacrifices to keep doing the film, just to get the free time to do it, right?
Well, exactly, because it's extremely time-consuming.
Like the ability to pay rent.
Yeah, you have to live while you're doing this, right? I mean, because it's not about paying just for the film. It's about paying for you to survive. I mean, it's the same with music, of course, too. You know, it's not just about paying for the albums. The artist, the person writing the songs also has to survive while they're writing the songs and while they're living before they record the album and after they record the album, you know. Yeah.
Well, it's hard, you know. So a lot of my work is, you know, like I worked for the Free Speech Radio News Network here in Chile for a while. And they would pay, you know, a respectful wage for a radio story. And now, you know, they've gone under, they've run out of funding and, you know, so I, my journalism has been largely voluntary for people that I have tremendous respect for, like KABU, like Democracy Now. But this is something that I feel that it's how I survive is by being myself and doing this. But there are financial challenges to journalism and art these days. But I like what you're saying about Portland and where what you're observing in the Black Lives Matter movement. And I want to get there. And I think that this context of what's been happening in Chile in the last little over a year will help us build some really cool bridges. So give me one second here and I'm going to get us there.
Let's do it. Let's hear about that bridge. Yeah.
Okay. So here's the thing. So sticking with the chronological, we're going to get to the Constitution. Some important stuff happened first. So we were talking about 2016, 2017, 2018, these movements are coming together in the streets. Students, you know, you wouldn't imagine seeing some 16-year-old student out there throwing a Molotov cocktail for Social Security. But in Chile, it happens, right? And so we see these movements come together for Social Security and an end to the horrible privatized scheme we have here called the AFP. For free education, for union rights, all of this coming together in the streets. And then on October 18th, 2018, there was a paradigm shift moment. So it was precipitated by, it was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, where twice in a period of 3 weeks, the government raised the metro fare in Santiago. So you think, well, this is it's pretty small raise. It's a quarter or something like that, you know, 25 cents. It's, but when we know that over 40% of people in Chile live on under $500 a month, and a lot of them in Santiago spend up to 30% of that on metro fare, this is huge. When Chile's conservative billionaire president, Sebastián Piñera, does things that makes people feel like he doesn't understand how hard life is for them, they're incredibly inspired to be on the streets, right? And so starting on the 18th of October, 2019, something happened called the Estallido Social, right? Which is the social explosion. So this was more than a protest movement. This was took us to, you know, what the UN calls a non-international conflict or a low-grade civil war.
It's like it was like the entirety of the population in the streets. I mean, it just looked like there was no room for anybody to cram into the streets of this of Santiago. And there's so many people.
Right. So we have, you know, Santiago, a city of around 7 million people, and marches were over a million people sometimes. So we're talking about
basically everyone,
percentage of people participating. There were a lot of things that sort of happened at once. So on the 18th, as well as there being a lot of peaceful protests, there was a coordinated series of still unexplained arson attacks. 19 metro stations, 6 Walmarts, and the private electric company which services the country, Enel, it's an Italian company, all burned on the first night.
Sounds very choreographed.
Well, there's no information on that. Believe me,
but given the history of sabotage in Chile and so many other countries, like the way that sounds, it just sounds like a sabotage. I mean, I'm not saying that I have any inside information on it. It's just that we know that there's a history of that kind of thing. Of course, there's also a history of left wingers blowing up stuff too. But the idea of sabotage cannot be discounted.
Cops did this to justify what came next, and that's totally up in the air. I don't, as a journalist, have anything I can report to you on the other than that they happened. And it continued for months. The national newspaper, El Mercurio, which is pretty conservative, and was sort of on the dictator's side during the dictatorship. They say El Mercurio mente, right? The Mercurio lies. But their offices burned. A lot of conservative political party offices burned. And here's where we start to get to this point that, of course, the president, Piñera, responded by saying, we are at war with a powerful enemy who is the Chilean people. He called the state of emergency, suspending a lot of the meager rights that people had under the dictatorship constitution. And he called the military out on the streets, which was really traumatizing. I think, a lot of the people here have grew up during dictatorship and may have lost somebody, and so to have the military shooting people on the streets again was really traumatizing for a lot of people. And so the response, was really dramatic. Piñera's approval rating fell to 5% in the polling firm he himself owned. And so people were saying, we're not at war, we're united, right? And talking to Mapuche community members at this time, what they're saying to me is, oh my God, the Chileans finally get it. We have been facing this kind of military on our streets repression for hundreds of years. And now you guys finally get it. And now you are in the streets with us. And so we saw that even, I think, before the 18th of September, 2019, while social issues were uniting, this racial divide, which has been horrible for so many generations in Chile, the racism against indigenous people was finally starting to come together. And you saw, more and more Mapuche flags in the urban core and taken up as a symbol of the resistance and as a symbol of unity. Right. And so that brought us to a point where, when the president's at 5%, he's making concessions left and right, trying to, retain some control of the country. Remember that the COP 25 and an APEC summit that was supposed to have Trump and Xi Jinping in Santiago were both scheduled for the months after that uprising.
COP, the climate summit, and the APEC, the Asia Pacific Economic Summit, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so all these international leaders, including Xi Jinping and Trump, are supposed to come to Santiago. And, like we see with the history of these summit protests and stuff like that, the way that people have been able to successfully block them is if they're canceled, if they raise such a ruckus way beforehand that they cancel it. And that happened, right? So, Piñera was trying to reestablish control, offering all these concessions. He was unable to. The summits were canceled. One of the concessions that he did offer was to hold a referendum on whether or not to rewrite the dictatorship era constitution. Right?
Interesting.
Behind closed doors by members of the
Piñera
and William Buchanan, who later received the Nobel Prize for this neoliberal constitution that has really high quorums for a lot of social issue reforms and makes itself really hard to remove. So we had the referendum a week and a half ago, and 78% of Chileans voted for a totally new constitution.
Massive. And so is it clear what that means? What the constitution is, the constitution already written, or now it's like a matter of coming up with what is the new constitution?
Right. So there was two questions. One, apruebo o rechazo, right? So I approve one by 78%. I approve that we're going to call a constitutional convention. And the second question was, who is going to be who is this constitutional convention going to be made up of? Well, it'd be 50% members of parliament and 50% civil society actors who are not currently political office holders, or will it be all civil society actors and no politicians? And by a vote of 79%, so they voted to reject all politicians and make this all civil society actors to vote in the Constitution. And so in April, we're going to have another election to elect these members of the Constitutional Convention. Anna Tujou, a lot of musicians, artists, historians. It's going to be an interesting group, a lot of religious leaders. It's going to be a real sort of California gubernatorial race full of characters. And of course, the parliamentarians are trying to get themselves back into the process to pass a bill that would say if they quit now, they could still run for that. That hasn't happened yet, but it could. Another thing that folks are trying to get a vote for in the Chilean Congress right now is whether to have dedicated seats in the Constitutional Convention for indigenous peoples. And so this is a real question. All these issues, how are they going to be addressed by the new constitution? Will Mapuches finally have their sovereignty recognized? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of politically where we are now. And I wanted to share with folks that, so in addition to Veins of Resistance, I participated in a project called Disidentes, or Dissidents. And so if you look up Serie Disidentes, there's a YouTube channel, and there's 4 5-minute shorts. They're in black and white. If you go to the gear wheel in the bottom right-hand corner of YouTube, you can put those English subtitles on. And this was a collaboration with multiple other Chilean collectives, and I'm really tremendously proud to have been a part of it. It shows me what really good editing looks like, and part of why I want to continue to study editing. And so that talks about what it was like to be in the streets in the days after the estallido social, the social explosion of October 18, 2019 began.
Great.
Right. What happened is when the military were called out on the street and the state of emergency was called, the front line of the protest changed from and I see this happening with you guys in Portland too, right? Where it changes from a banner to a shield wall. That they changed up the munitions on us. Over those months, we had 460 eyes lost from bullets. And the bullets, the police claimed they were rubber bullets. Turned out they were 80% lead and other metals, and they came lodged in all over the place, including people's eyeballs. And that, it's a tragic level of repression, and multiple people lost both their eyes. And this level of mutilation and maiming quickly surpassed records held by Palestine and Kashmir, where this kind of oppression had been seen before. We had over 20,000 people made it to hospital. Over 30,000 were arrested. So many more were didn't make it to hospital. Were treated by valiant street medics, and even these field hospitals where you. So a lot of these situations are very hard to get a stretcher into because, folks are taking fire. And so they go up there with a sortie. The street medics have their own shields, and they're trying to get somebody out as quick as possible. But with over 30 deaths of protesters just in a couple months after, it was a rough situation. And we continue to see it, even on the day of the anniversary, 18th of October this year, I was out there and more than 600 people were arrested, multiple churches burned. And this is just this state of non-international conflict, right? Where me growing up in the United States, I think of a burning church and I think of racist terrorism during the civil rights movement. But this is part of this, I learned in Chile, is that for many in Chile, the church is a symbol of hundreds of years of colonial violence.
Yes.
And so, so churches are often, I've been outside of a lot of burning churches.
I actually was at a very interesting church burning at the Lakota Reservation many years ago. It was a church burning / healing ceremony as it was billed.
Yeah,
it was an old abandoned church that had been bought by a Lakota guy who was going to do other things with it, but they symbolically burnt it before doing anything else with it.
That's interesting.
As you guys are presumably, as I'm sure you are, at least occasionally, maybe a little more than occasionally, looking at what's going on in the United States with the various, with the uprising here, as well as with the neo-fascist billionaire in the White House, do you have any particular thoughts in terms of what people up here might take away from the successful militant movements in Chile in particular and other countries as well? Of course, we could also talk about I'm sure you've also been keeping track of events in Bolivia, which is also very interesting. Absolutely. You know, lots of other places, lots
another
going
great
on.
Popular victory, right? Like, yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, you know, for folks who don't know, over a little over a year ago, Evo Morales was unseated by another CIA backed coup in Latin America of a, you know, an indigenous leader of Bolivia who was part of the party movement towards socialism, right? So same pattern of the United States meddling, in this case for natural gas, in the affairs of socialist leaning Latin American countries. And so after more than a year of rule by the evangelical coup makers, in which they targeted a lot of indigenous people and killed them, dead bodies in the streets, horrible human rights crimes, as well as ignoring COVID. They managed to hold a free and fair election, and Evo Morales' Movement Towards Socialism party won in a huge landslide. And so we see that, and then a week later, the huge landslide for a new constitution in Chile. We say, okay, wow, so is this another wave of popular power sweeping Latin American politics, right? And so what, you know, the election results in the United States indicate that they are maybe not part of that popular wave. What I would say for folks in the United States and around the world is that, one, the incredible unity, that unity is strength, that unity is power, that sometimes we have to sort of leave politics at the gate and these things that could cause conflict between different groups, they've managed to set aside and focus on symbols that unite them. Which can
do
be,
you have
quite,
any
like, is, for example,
are you thinking of something in particular, like around the question of flags or something, or what are you thinking of?
I was going to talk about Negro Matapacos. Mm-hmm. Right, so Negro Matapacos was a street dog, a black street dog.
Oh yeah,
black cop killer dog,
the Lucanicos of Chile,
right? Exactly. And so, and he actually died in 2017 after many great battles with the police. And, but he would always go out to the protests and fight the police. And so, rather than having this sort of, direct commentary on the sort of diversity of tactics conversation that sweeps Chile and, you know, people, obviously there's a lot of different opinions on this stuff. There's been an incredible lionization of Il Matapaco, right? This
wonderful
dog. And so people he's on t-shirts, he's in giant statues, he's paper mache, he's everywhere. And what it is it's a way of showing love and affection and support for the Cabros de la Primera Linea, right? Like the women and the men that are up there on the front lines in a more combative role. And so they found a way to support the folks who are out there defending the protest. And it is a defensive role because with the munitions we're facing, peaceful protest is not possible without a defensive perimeter from the
absolutely
shield wall. And because so before the Estallido, we were having CS mixed into the water cannons. A level 4 CS. CS is measured on tear gas is measured on a level of 1 to 5 in the US. Until recently, been typically a 2, Chile typically a 4. Pretty strong stuff that can cause miscarriages, fainting, according to medical studies by the University of Chile and others. So that's what it was like before. And then so after the SDU, they started mixing lye into the water cannons, which can cause third degree burns. One person lost 60% of the skin on their body. And so they also added arsenic powder to tear gas dispensers on a couple of the armored vehicles, like just like right in the beginning of the trailer to Veins of Resistance. I encourage you to check out at veinsofresistance.net. There's this military vehicle that comes zooming right at you. It's very hard to get away, especially filming it. And, and they have gas that comes out of the vehicle in big clouds, right? They have tanks in the vehicle. And so they start putting arsenic in those tanks, which causes nausea and can knock you out. And it's arsenic, it can kill you if you get enough of it. And so they up the munitions, you know, in addition to the buckshot, the rocket propelled tear gas canisters, the these larger balls that were, you know, the balines that are like, you know, almost as big as a tennis ball, huge bruises across a whole torso. And then the medium sized, the perdigones, right, that are the ones becoming lodged, as well as the buckshot. So in the face of these munitions, you know, that's why the people are organizing. And, you know, obviously for any one person on the front line, there's so many support roles. There's the medics, and legal, and everybody else that's out there supporting these folks and now demanding their freedom. Many of them are in prison now. You know, but that was the big change, that was necessary to create the kind of unity in the streets, that brought the president to allow us to rewrite the Constitution, but made it necessary. Right.
It's a wonderful way to communicate, using the dog as the symbol for this kind of militancy, rather than sort of taking on the question of diversity of tactics head on like that, which might not be as much of a controversial issue as it has been in the past here. Although that debate here is also changing in interesting ways, with a lot less of the sort of, you know, knee-jerk condemnation of more militant tactics, and a lot more sort of understanding it in context, and also understanding the provocative nature of the police, who are always attacking anybody who starts marching in the streets, of course.
Yeah. Well, or looking to foment violence. Like they'll play one football club off against another, you know, they're always looking for something. But yeah, so I think that's one thing to talk about, that sort of, escalation in tactics and social movements uniting in the face of it and trying to protect themselves. And I think that there's quite a bit to be learned from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Got any predictions for what's going to happen up here in the US over the next few days? any random predictions before we go?
Oh, you know, I don't predict the future, but I know that there's a lot of people that are tremendously inspired to be in the streets on a lot of different sides of it, and we'll see what happens. But I know that, you know, the Proud Boys in Portland.
You didn't say Civil War.
40,000 people in Portland, and then 200 people show up. So I would encourage people to, like, you know, look at, like, observable facts. And not live in sort of an online world, but like in a relationship with the people in their community world. And a lot of good can get done there.
Good advice. Get off the computer, go out into the streets. Huh? Thanks so much, Joshua Tucker. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Hey, David, likewise. And if there's ever anything I can do, if anybody wants to collaborate, you know, I'm always into working together with the indie media crew and lifting up people. And I love working with the new reporters at KBOO. And so you can, my portfolio website is Joshua Tree Tucker, the tree that grows in the woods, joshuatreetucker.com. It's my email too, is joshuatreetucker@gmail.com. You know, so I'm here. And if this stuff is interesting to you, let's talk.
Excellent. There will be more. Yes. Good. Take care. Talk to you soon.
All the best, David. Thank you. Keep up the good work, man. Next time we got to talk about the protest songs down here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yes. Art is a part of the movement.
Oh, huge. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Hugs, man.
You too. See you. And thanks for tuning into that conversation with filmmaker Joshua Tree Tucker. And like he said, joshuatreetucker.com. Go check out that amazing documentary, veinsofresistance.net. And I will be talking on Friday with a host of various shows on the internet, producer of other shows on television, Ron Placone in Los Angeles. And for anybody in Portland, come to Revolution Hall today, 3 p.m. We'll be having a protest there and then a march to the waterfront and back afterwards. And yeah, that's it for now. Oh, if you're looking to hear this broadcast in podcast form, all of these video interviews go out in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for tuning in. And remember, don't pay the rent. Mutual aid will get us through. Trust your neighbors. Turn off your computer and go outside. Talk to you soon.